All right, yeah, we're on the right slide. So I'm just going to speak, just give a little bit more background on the qualified opportunity zones themselves. As Chris alluded to, these are census tracts, geographic or population census tracts that generally meet the definition of a low-income community. What you really need to know is that's generally speaking an area where 20-plus percent of the residents are living in quote-unquote poverty. But it also includes certain adjacent or contiguous census tracts that may not fit that low-income definition themselves. But they're next to one of these areas, and they also have to have a relatively low median family income to qualify. These census tracts, these opportunity zones, were designated by the governors of each state, generally speaking, and they were ultimately certified once they were designated. They were certified by Treasury last year. Governors had the freedom to designate up to 25% of their otherwise qualifying census tracts as an opportunity zone. So there was a limit on how many could be designated. But I think the main takeaway here is these zones are established. They are set. There's not going to be a change unless this program gets extended or renewed and they allow additional zones to be designated. But the ones that we have today are set. And you know, we've got a link up here to a map where you guys can go. There's an interactive map. You can literally look at it. Type in an address if you've got a property in mind to see if it's in a zone. It's a pretty user-friendly tool. Next slide here, just a picture from of some Texas qualified opportunity zones. And it's difficult to glean a lot from just this one map, but basically these areas that are highlighted in blue are the opportunity zones. Nationwide, this is a nationwide program. There's almost 9,000 opportunity zones throughout the United States. And in Texas, we have 628 different opportunity zones covering 145 different counties.
Now, Brandon, are these always just really poor areas? Kind of, is that the only place you find these opportunity zones?
No, not at all, Kevin. As I was saying, you know, there's some of these, the way the opportunity zones were defined, even if you're not technically a low-income community, if you're close to a low-income community, you were eligible to be designated potentially. And so what you'll find if you actually start looking around is throughout the state, throughout the country, there are some fantastic geographic areas to be invested in. Just as an example, the entire downtown of Houston essentially is an opportunity zone. Similarly, I believe in San Antonio. And if you look at all the major cities in Texas, there are great areas right around the downtown areas. So there's some really, really good areas that you'd want to look at. And I think a lot of that's due to the fact, Kevin, that, you know, the data that was used for this is a little bit dated, and a number of these areas were already experiencing gentrification. Mm-hmm. And so there were already, you know, areas that were on the move and up and coming, and so there's some fantastic areas out there.
Some surprising things, like college towns, because yes, it's measured on income. So you can have a beautiful little college town that has no economic strife whatsoever in it that's a qualified opportunity zone. Okay.
Because how much
West Texas Permian Basin, there's opportunity zones out there, and we believe that these funds can be utilized to drill wells. It's just a really smattering of things that isn't intuitive. So let's talk about what happens if you do this right. If you form the fund right, which we'll talk about. If you form the QASBs right, which we'll talk about. If you invest in the right type of property, which we'll talk about. What's the gravy here? Why are we even talking about this? Well, the threshold is you've got a client who's got a capital gain or a gain that's taxed to the capital gain. So understand where you may have picked up in the conversation in the earlier panel about the carried interest thing, where there's a glitch in the statute about whether 1231. It's the simplest thing to think about what a 1231 asset is depreciable real estate. That's a nice, easy example of that, okay? So in that statute, there's a glitch that looks like the statute doesn't even apply to that because it doesn't cross-reference 1231. Here, the statute was clear, anything that's a capital gain or taxed as a capital gain. So that clearly includes real estate, but that's where you get your stock gains. That's where you get your sale of stock in a privately held business or membership interest in an LLC. Okay, those are all taxable generally as capital gains. So you start with that. You've got a client who's got a capital gain. You're going to be relied upon as counselor of record to make sure that your clients are aware of this. Okay, but if they do it and they do all these things right, here's the benefit. One, the gain is treated as not happening until 12/31/26. Okay? It's reported, but you have to check a little box that basically says we're going to treat this as opportunity zone gain, and you don't. It's treated as the fancy word for tax lawyers is recognized. That gain is not recognized until 12/31/06. Okay? That's number one. Number two, if you hold that investment for 5 years, 10% of that gain goes away forever. The old gain. We're still talking about the old gain because we're going to talk about new gain here in just a second. Okay? If you hold it for 7 years, an additional 5% of that gain goes away. Now, the way it goes away is in a basis mechanism that we're not even going to talk about because it'll make your head spin around backwards. Just understand that if you hold the investment 5 years, 10% of the gain goes away forever. If you hold it 7 years, a total of 15% goes away. Now, what? Do your math here. All of this has to happen before the end of 2026.